listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.
Hi, you're here with Danny and Chris, and we are getting inside the very interesting minds of your favourite writers. In this very Australian and occasionally rowdy podcast, we chat about books, the writing process, and the social, political, and personal influences that inspire writing. Most importantly, we enjoy a good laugh and take the writing, but not ourselves, too seriously. We'd love it if you could provide a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, and the most interesting reviews, all the ones that make us laugh, will get a shout out on the podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe. You can also follow us on Instagram or Facebook, Words and Nerds Podcast. We were recently very kindly reviewed by book reviewer and blogger Teresa Smith Writes, who said, "What I loved most about this podcast was the cozy feel to it. I had the impression throughout that we could all have been sitting in a lounge room together chatting about books and movies and everything else in between." Today, we welcome UK best-selling dark fantasy horror author of the Gabriel Davenport series, The Making of Gabriel Davenport and A Shining in the Shadows, two books that I really loved and thought just kept getting better. Thank you so much for joining us today, Beverly. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
It's wonderful to get to talk to you. We like talking to people on the other side of the world, so this is becoming a bit of a hobby for us now, especially the UK.
Oh, I think Australians always like the UK, don't they?
We're like your baby, aren't we? Like the UK's little baby.
We're a troublesome child. To get us underway a little bit, I was reading, I know that you had a lovely interview with Huffington Post. I was reading some of your inspirations and some of the authors that you talk about, and I find, especially given your style of writing, Neil Gaiman and C.S. Lewis were two that's really sprung to mind. What is it about those two in particular?
I think C.S. Lewis really was my first foray into fantasy. I still actually remember going to the library when I was about 8 or 10 and going in and looking at all those spines on the shelves and getting really excited if I saw a new C.S. Lewis book. And I just read them and devoured them. And I think really that was my seeds into just fantasy as a whole. And then everything just developed from there.
Neil Gaiman is one of my personal favourites as well. I love everything Neil writes. In the interview, you talked about the fact that he takes this magical realism and makes you believe in spider gods and cities under the streets of London.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I just don't know how he does it. I mean, if you actually read the synopsis of his books to anyone who doesn't read books, they would just have a very faraway look on their face because they sound bonkers. They really do sound bonkers. But when you're reading them, like you say, he just puts you in the moment, and it takes a really special kind of writer to be able to do that.
100%. He wrote my favourite children's book, which is the children's book for adults, which is called Fortunately the Milk.
I love that one. The Graveyard book as well, that's another of my personal favourite.
And I think that style and flow of writing is something that seems to echo across into what you tend to write as well, that flow.
Book one, The Making of Gabriel Davenport, it actually kept me awake at night for two reasons, because it scared me to death and because I just couldn't wait to see what happened next. As a mother myself, I put myself absolutely in Beth's shoes, and it was really horrible because I was picturing what was happening in the story in my own house, and I'm like, oh, wow, I've got to stop doing that. So
were you about to ask for advice as to how to get out of the situation? Is this why we're doing the podcast?
So she's a young mother at home, snowed in, alone with her baby, trying to fight this demon. And I just thought, how did this idea come to you, Beverly?
Oh, gosh. Right, here we go. Well, the first book, The Making of Gabriel Davenport, actually started life off in 2014 as a 3,000-word piece that I was going to enter into a competition, one of these competitions where you have the bit of the novel at the beginning, you send it in and the editor maybe looks at it if you're extremely lucky. Well, I wrote this thing and promptly stuck it in a folder and forgot about it. The date passed for the competition and the story just stayed there. And then in the first weeks of 2015, I picked it up again because, you know, new year, new beginnings. Yes, let's see what I've got here that actually might work. And I looked at it and I thought, ooh, there's something that might make a story here. And I think the idea about the box containing something awful came first. And then the Davenports formed in my head, and it was just really all go from then on.
I just found the juxtaposition between just her having this normal life and then the paranormal interrupting that normal life just so frightening, because she at that time had no interest or didn't dabble in the paranormal at all, and it was just so real. And even though the book was about vampires and about demons, I think setting it in that reality just made it even more terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It really all comes down to like a twisted branch of fate. I mean, if they hadn't gone on holiday, if Stu hadn't glanced in that particular window at that moment, all of their lives would have been so different. And I think ifs play such a big part in everyone's lives.
Absolutely. And I think as a mother myself, I really liked the idea of the demon had underestimated her love for her son, because I know most parents would sacrifice themselves and just want to protect their baby. And that's exactly what happened to Beth. So it really spoke to me as not only as an avid reader, as a human and a mother too.
That's what I wanted the readers to say. Yeah, sorry, I went a bit wobbly then. I'm back.
You went a bit wobbly?
Good-o.
I'm leaving that in.
Yes, it's the gremlin in the works. It's coming out.
That's your, again, next book, Gremlin Down the Line.
Throughout both novels, there is the constant conflict between the paranormal and religion, and it seems that they have an inability to coexist, and even Noah loses his faith. Clove attempts to bridge the gap between the two by saying, your saviour was reborn, Noah. Resurrection is not an evil state of being, but Noah still seems to struggle with this. How do you see the paranormal and religion coexisting?
That's a really, really interesting question. I think Noah's conversation with Clove in A Shining in the Shadows was one of my favourite dialogue interactions in that book. And it was such an easy piece to write because they actually were both sparring in my head the whole time. It was one of those instances where I couldn't write quickly enough because I had one on one shoulder arguing and the other one on the other shoulder arguing back. I really did give him a hard time. Yeah, I think we'll agree on that, too, and what he lost. Just completely trampled on his faith and everything he thought he knew about religion.
And we see that in the second book when he changes somewhat and loses that. So I'm interested what happens in the third book.
The thing about Noah is that the people that he lost had done absolutely nothing wrong, nothing to deserve the kind of the horror that had happened to them. And in the end, I think Noah was just struggling with the concept that no matter how strong his faith was, that the evil and the darkness out there just seemed to be stronger.
And that's an interesting concept too, because, again, a lot of authors who write horror or write those style things, the people who are lost, there is some reason behind it. There is something deep in the shadows that they've done that comes out later on that's why the sacrifice. So I think the idea of they haven't done anything, it's just part of it, makes it that little bit more terrifying.
Yes, because you can put yourself in that situation.
And the demon is just so relentless. You know, you see the vampires, they have some humanity, they have some empathy, but the demon just does have nothing. And I like the backstory of the demon. That was really unexpected, but I really liked that because it gave us an understanding. And even though the demon had lost his humanity a long time ago.
Yeah, I think it was important to have that. I mean, you can't just have the bad guy and not tell people why he's the bad guy. I mean, there was a reason why he had become what he had become. And really, you kind of had to feel sorry for him in a way, because this kid, some awful things happened to him, and then he just ended up how he did.
And trying to get his life back in some way. I fell in love with the three boys, Teal, Moth, and Gabriel, especially in the second book when they really came to light and formed this relationship. And throughout the novels, the humanity clings to them, even though they have turned and they are now living in the vampire world. Moth was always on the lookout for his weaker sibling. That part of Moth's humanity remained. And even with Clove, emotion had become alien to him. But since making Gabriel, it was rising from the ashes of his heart. Why was it important for you to create vampires with such humanity?
Let me have a think about that one. I just didn't want them to be sinful creatures. I mean, the very best creatures have flaws and strengths, and I wanted my vampires to carry both of those. I mean, really, they are the heroes in their own story, even if what they have to do to a human mind is morally wrong. I wanted to run their emotions and actions alongside that human element and keep it kind of balanced for both. And then that way the reader gets to choose who they fall in love with. It would have been a completely different story if their humanity was lost.
And it also does, again, it also avoids making them that cardboard cutout vampire, which has sort of been a theme of our discussions we've had, is that the idea of avoiding just presenting the carbon copy, that's a vampire. You know, everyone's got their own version, their own variants on it, and their own thing that makes the vampire different and compelling.
I found really interesting that we loved and empathized with the boys, and yet they are killers, and we see them hunt and kill humans for their blood, and yet we still love them. And Gabriel questions, would I become as heartless in the years to come? Some part of me still clung to what I once was, but still I killed people now. I think that's a real credit to your writing to still be able to love these characters, even though they go and hunt and kill people and feed from them.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I wanted to take my readers kind of on a little journey where they put themselves in the character's position and ask themselves what they would do. I mean, before the events at the end of Gabriel, like Noah would not have questioned his own moral compass, but by Shadows, he's delving deep into his own ethics and his integrity. And for the boys, really, all they're doing is trying to survive.
And that's always for me the anomaly when it comes to vampires, especially when they've got the vampire with that touch of humanity, or the vampire who's trying to do good, is that at the heart of the story, at the end of the day, they do have to feed. They do have to eat, and they do have to survive. So, yeah, as you said, it's that how do they now evaluate their own moral compass on it goes from being we're hunting to kill to this is just like getting a snack. This is our equivalent of having a meal and having and balancing that part. And that's where, again, having that element of humanity still attached to them really draws them out.
They had to have the blood. It wasn't something they chose to do. It was inside them, and they had to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that is their true instinct. That is the main instinct that they have, no matter what. That trumps everything else, is that their need for the blood. I mean, my vampires are not killing machines. I like to think that they'll maybe feed from a person, and that will be enough for a couple of nights. But I do like the idea that instinct is always there, and that's why they are such dangerous creatures.
Life is full of moral ambiguity, so I liked how that was reflected in the book. The reader, I know I did, I fell in love with Teal through the eyes of both Moth and Gabriel, and they say, I don't know how he did it, finding the light in the darkness. And then Teal is described as glaring up at us, and his lips settled in such a sweet smile. He was like sunshine. No wonder Moth loved him. And in true Moth style, Moth says, who the fuck couldn't love him? I think it's really important, especially for our society, to have these strong emotional bonds between boys, especially because we don't often see it. Was this what you intended when you were writing this?
I think so, yes. I mean, I'm always thrilled when readers pick up on this and realise what an important message it is. Because nowadays, I mean, even nowadays, boys are taught that to have feelings and to express them makes them somehow weaker. I just don't understand that.
And I think coming from vampires, who are dangerous creatures, and then them having that brotherly bond, and then two of them, you know, falling in love, I thought that was really special, because it showed that you can be frightening and dangerous and mysterious, and yet you can still have these beautiful, tender relationships.
Yeah, I mean, as a writer, if I can address that issue and show that emotion doesn't lessen what you are, that it's healthy and needed and beautiful, I feel really privileged to be able to do that. I wanted to show that it wasn't anything to do with gender. I mean, they could easily have been three girls. They were just all thrown together and had to deal with all of the nightmares that the night threw at them. Yeah. I mean, bonds form when you are hand in hand with danger. And Teal just brings out their protective instinct.
I think you're absolutely right when you said it didn't matter about gender, because when Moth and Gabriel were falling for each other, for me, I knew they were both boys, but it didn't even come into it at all. It was just so beautiful, from the conflict to the issues that they had and the shared love of Teal and the fear, and then they came together like they needed each other. So it transcended all that gender stuff. It was really beautiful.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm really pleased when readers mention that, because for me that's a really important part of the book. Although I did have one Amazon review who said that he really liked the book, but he gave me one star because he couldn't deal with all that gay vampire stuff.
And if you're winning those sort of Amazon reviews, you're doing it right.
All that gay vampire stuff, that's great. I'm going to go look up that review. That's wonderful. For all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, you liked the book, but... Yeah.
You liked the book, except for the major characters and the major relationship. So, yeah, actually, that's an interesting dilemma. I would love to actually now go and find that person. Maybe that's another podcast, Finding Amazon Reviewers. And
I mean, as a writer, you're taught you never respond to bad reviews. And I read that what planet are you on? You know,
it's the equivalent of don't read the comments in general on the internet.
Maybe he just liked book one because it didn't have all that gay vampire stuff.
Oh. And the thing is, it's not as if it's a neurotic vampire. Is it?
There's no sparkling. There's no werewolves. I mean,
no. It was actually tender and beautiful. There was nothing cheap about it, and that's why I loved it. Because I just saw these boys, and they needed each other, and they had this beautiful bond. I really liked it. I can't wait till book three.
I hope it's worth it.
I find the relationship between humans and vampires in any book you read is always really complex and delicate. And then we see Clove, who doesn't particularly need to save Gabriel. He's motivated by destroying the demon. How did you hope to balance the relationships between humans and vampires?
Oh, crikey, let's have a think. Well, in the first book, they have quite an uneasy alliance. I mean, Clove has become involved purely to destroy what he sees as the evil force. The humans in the manor really mean little to him. But I think he respects the courage that they show. But it's very different in the second book. I mean, Olivia's relationship with the young vampires is tied together with her need. She knows that helping them will help Noah. And despite everything, seeing Gabe again and knowing that he's okay, relatively speaking, I think that really, really, it means such a lot to her. But underneath, she's still very aware that they're killers, which goes back to what we were saying before. I think it's really lucky that she's such a strong character, and I played on the strengths that she has as the story progressed. I mean, that was my balance, the fact that she knew how dangerous they were, but she chose to do it anyway.
And they're bound together by a much greater enemy than themselves, so they come together to fight this other enemy.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I loved her relationship with Moth, though, as well, because she just saw straight through him.
Yeah, they're almost reflections of each other, weren't they?
Yes, yes.
Human vampire world and reflections of that kind of hard personality, but with that underneath, you know, that tenderness underneath.
Yeah, yeah.
I found Beth probably one of the most tragic characters, not only a book, but probably that I've ever read. She went from this really protective mother to this childlike and vulnerable person, and then we see what happens to her in book two, obviously. And I thought the description was particularly beautiful. Her memories still existed, strung along her consciousness like little blisters waiting to be pierced, because I thought she was just so fragile. And then she lets the bird in, and you're thinking, oh, no, Beth, come on.
Don't do that.
So when you were creating Beth, what were your thoughts?
Okay, right at the beginning of the book, at the beginning of Gabriel, I just wanted to show her as a strong, independent woman, totally in love with her family, just a normal woman taking a career break to look after her baby. That way, the readers can empathise with the human element of what she was. But then what happened in the cottage is something that she could never, ever have imagined. I mean, a lot of readers have said that they truly empathise with Beth, because, again, they put themselves in her place. And that was the thing that turned the dial up on the horror, the fact that they were imagining themselves in the same situation. I mean, the shock of what occurred on that night with the snow just robbed her of the best part of herself. Her scenes in shadows were really poignant, as I could still sense what she had been. But then it was as if there were silent witnesses. And what happened to her? I'm a really bad writer for doing that, aren't I?
No, on the contrary, it makes you magnificent.
I was really horrified, but I thought, wow, from Gabriel's perspective, that adds just another layer of what he has to go through. The poor kid.
Yeah, it's tough being a character in my books.
they need to form their own union. Unionising characters in Beverly's books.
But then I know on your Instagram, you speak about Gabe like he's your son or your nephew. You say, my boys.
I do. I've done that from the beginning, and people have just picked it up now. And I do. I have this very strong protective instinct for him. Well, for all my characters, but obviously Gabe, as he's my protagonist.
I had a similar experience when I was reading the three of them. I just love the three of them. I want to take them home.
People say, I want to look after them.
One of my favourite quotes from the novel, which you probably saw on one of my Instagram posts, was, love didn't come with a coat of water and sunlight. It crawled along the gutter, gathering debris in its wake, but flowered anyway. I love how it really turned these cliche ideas of romance out the window that we see from rom-coms all the time. And it became a real depiction of romantic love, which is, as we all know, messy and difficult and ugly and sometimes annoying and painful and beautiful all the same time.
Okay, well, none of the relationships in my books are easy. I just don't do normal, what people tend to think as normal relationships. But the thing is, I want to show any romantic angles to be really authentic. And like you say, it is all of those things that you mentioned. And I wanted it to feel really solid to everybody that read. You know, I wanted to show that disheveled side, the part that plays about in the gutter, and to see what blossomed. When I was writing, I didn't know how I would do it. So a lot of the scenes were just a real surprise to me.
I think that having that sort of realism in it and having the fact that it's messy and complex and at the same time wonderful, but it's all of those things at once, I think it actually makes it better for the reader as well, because I think that most people can't link up to that picture-perfect idea of romance and that sort of... It's very fake and it's very distant to a lot of people. And I think by having it as more complex, it's something that you can really hook into it. It makes you want to keep reading.
It's impossible to live up to all those rom-coms that you see.
Oh, you wouldn't want to live up to those rom-coms.
Yeah, true.
I don't want to do a shopping montage.
Oh, I do.
I know you do.
So is that how you're writing? Is that how your writing process works? Sometimes the characters drive the story for you?
Oh, gosh, my characters always drive the story. They just hijack it. I mean, when I'm writing, I kind of have the bare bones of what I would like to do. I kind of like have a middle section and I usually have the end. And then I kind of just let them loose and they just make their own way there. But quite often the things that I want to do, they just don't want to do and they go off in the opposite direction. But I think for me, that's the thrill and excitement of writing. It's finding magic in the places that they want to go and not where I want to go. I mean, if I ever get stalled, I'll get writer's block when I'm writing. It's because I know I'm pushing the characters in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. I mean, once I give them free rein, then they go off and that's it.
It's one of the reasons why you're so protective of them, really, isn't it? Because they just won't do what you want them to do. They won't go where you tell them to go. That's why you're protective of them.
Yeah, they're just teenagers. Just not
exactly. They don't behave, they don't do what you want, but you love them unconditionally.
Yes.
I found it interesting that Gabriel was the only character perspective to be written in first person and the others written in third. Was this an experiment? Did it come naturally because it was always really Gabe's story, or how did that come about?
Well, when I first wrote The Making of Gabriel Davenport, it was only ever going to be one book when I started off, so all the point of views were third. But when it got to Shadows and things have got a lot deeper and a lot more involved, I decided to take the sort of huge chance, really, and change his voice to first. I wanted the reader to be able to see really deeply through his eyes and his feelings, because it is ultimately his story, and all the characters and events, the books just spin around his story. He's kind of like a central cog, and everything else fits seamlessly into him as the story turns. But I did have a lot of sleepless nights wondering if I'd done the right thing, because it's kind of going against the grain of everything that they tell you to do is changing the point of view in a series.
I noticed it, but I certainly didn't find it jarring or anything. I got that it was Gabe's story and he was the centre, and it was nice to hear the other perspectives as well, though. It was nice to especially hear from Moth, because he was such... He came across one way, but he was another, so it was nice to get that perspective. And Olivia too, I guess, because she started to soften up.
Yeah, I love writing Moth because I just never know what's going to come out of his mouth.
And I think that I really like a lot of books that have that first-person narrative because it's so different from having it in that traditional third person. As an author, do you have a particular preference? I mean, how difficult is it to maintain that first-person narrative?
It's one of my... I would say it's my favourite perspective to write from, is first person. A lot of my previous writing has been done purely in first person. But for the needs of this actual series, because there's so many different characters, I had to take it into third. And I found once I got into third, I quite liked getting behind other people as well. But for me, I think first is always my true love, and I'm just really happy that people have accepted that, you know, they like Gabe in first, and that's how it's going to continue in book three.
The community of writers on Instagram, for example, they seem to be such a supportive group of people in the writing community. How has this helped you as a writer, and then how do you help others as writers?
Oh, I mean, without Instagram and Bookstagram, I mean, I wouldn't have been half as successful with the books. I mean, I first made my Instagram account, it was I think it was the summer before I published Gabriel, and the actual networking of finding like-minded people and writers who were going through the same thing. And we do, we just all support each other. It's like a real close-knit family. I've met a lot of them in real life. I've read their books. They read mine. We review each other's books. And there's just a fantastic community with Bookstagram, with the photographs, as you've seen. And every time I see, you know, one of my photos and my books come up on somebody's screen, it's just such a thrill. It's like, yay, somebody likes my book.
I know James Fahey, who we interviewed previously, calls it InstaFam.
InstaFam, yes, it is. It is. It's like a family.
That's very cute. Finally, I know you're not going to give me any spoilers, but what can we expect from book three and when can I read it?
Just you, no?
I mean, when I mean me, I mean everyone.
Yeah, well, it will be next year, but I have no idea when next year, more likely towards the summer. I was hoping for a spring publication, as the other two have been spring, but it's not going to be that because I want it to be absolutely spot on, and I owe it to my characters and to my readers not to give them something that doesn't go out with a bang. It's the darkest book I've ever written. It's giving me so many sleepless nights. People die in this book.
So I can look forward to a few more sleepless nights when I pick it up.
I mean, the characters, I drive them to their knees with the choices they have to make in this book. So there you go.
That is good. I like it.
And I want to point out for everyone at home, you also are allowed to read these books. It's not just Danielle. You can find Beverly at lots of different places, at beverlylee.com and Facebook, Beverly Lee, on Instagram at The Constant Voice and Twitter at Constant Voice. And you can also buy the books on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iBooks, Kobo. Of course, when you go to Amazon, let's not leave another review about, I like the book, but I don't really like that gay vampire stuff. Let's be more productive than that. Thank you, Beverly, for your time. It's been a wonderful pleasure.
Thank you very much.
It's been so awesome to speak to you because I've just really loved the books, and to get to speak to you about it has been a real joy. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. It is, honestly, it's such a pleasure to actually get to speak to people who love my books. I could rattle on all day. But I know you have an evening to get to, and I have to get to my day as well.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out. We really appreciate it. We'll talk again when book three comes.
Thank you. Absolutely, yes. I'm penciling you in already.
Fantastic.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.